This is lesson 8, in which we will move into Daniel chapter 11. We have seen that the theme of the book of Daniel is that the Most High God is ruler over all the realm of mankind, and he bestows rulership over nations and kingdoms on whom he wishes. This theme will really be evident as we look at the specificity and the amazing detail of the prophecies of chapter 11. In fact, it is this very specificity that causes liberal scholars whose view of God is very small to claim that the book of Daniel could not have been written by Daniel in the 6th century BC as prophecy, that is, looking forward, but it must have been written as completed history looking back from the 2nd century BC. By the time we get to chapter 10, Daniel already knows a great deal about the future of his people. From chapters 2 and 7 and 8, he had learned that there will be these four earthly kingdoms that will reign over Israel. He had also learned that there would be a little horn, a king, that would wage war with the saints and would persecute his people for 3.5 years before the kingdom of God would be set up. He had also learned that a time period of 70 weeks, or 490 years, had been decreed for his people and their holy city, Jerusalem. In other words, Daniel had already been the recipient of a lot of bad news about his people. The desolations for Israel and the temple would not end with the completion of the 70 years of captivity, and Israel's sin was not over because she had not repented and returned to the Lord. And that brings us to the last three chapters of the book of Daniel, chapters 10, 11, and 12. Remember that they are all one event that Daniel experiences in the third year of Cyrus the Persian. Let's review the structure of chapters 10 through 12. The entire content of chapter 10 constitutes an introduction to the revelation that is contained in chapters 11 and 12. Actually, the introduction extends through the first verse of chapter 11. The next section is chapter 11, verse 2 through chapter 12. I've written verse 4 on the slide, but really it should be ending at verse 3. And this section, this second section, is divided itself into two major divisions. The first is chapter 11, verse 2 through 35. This deals with the immediate future from the perspective of Daniel, and it goes from the time of Darius or Cyrus to Antiochus Epiphanes. This is a period of about 375 years. The second subdivision is chapter 11, verse 36 through chapter 12, verse 3, and this section deals with the far future, the end times, just before the second advent of Christ. And then there's a final message of revelation given to Daniel in chapter 12, verses 4 through 13. When we went through chapter 10 last week, we saw that there was a certain man in linen who may or may not have been a theophany, that is, a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ. And we saw by looking ahead to chapter 12, verses 5 through 7, that there were also two angels present, one of whom might be the one Daniel described as one who resembled a human being. One of those present, or perhaps more than one of those present, gave Daniel a message, literally it is a word, of great conflict. While looking at chapter 10 last week, we saw that there had already been a conflict in the spiritual realm just in the matter of the delivery of the message to Daniel. But chapters 11 and 12 speak of earthly rulers and events. The first verse of chapter 11 is really a continuation of whichever angel or being, perhaps the man in linen, is speaking in chapter 10, other than Daniel, of course. Daniel's not the one speaking. Let's back up to verse 18 of chapter 10 to get the context. Then this one with human appearance touched me again and strengthened me, and he said, O man of high esteem, do not be afraid. Peace be with you. Take courage and be courageous. Now as soon as he spoke to me, I received strength and said, May my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. Then he said, Do you understand why I came to you? But I shall now return to fight against the prince of Persia, so I am going forth, and behold, the prince of Greece is about to come. However, I will tell you what is inscribed in the writing of truth. Yet there is no one who stands firmly with me against these forces except Michael, your prince. And in the first year of Darius the Mede, I arose to be an encouragement and a protection for him." So do you see that this angel or being with human appearance is still talking at the beginning of chapter 11? And he says that 2 years prior to the time that he and Daniel are having this exchange, he, this angel, or perhaps the man in linen, arose to be an encouragement and a protection for Michael. Since we know that Michael is an archangel, a very powerful angel, then the angel or being who is speaking to Daniel must also be very powerful, more powerful than the angel who required Michael's help to get past the demonic prince of Persia who held him up for 21 days. Some scholars think that the speaker, beginning at verse 21, where it says, "I will tell you what is inscribed in the writing of truth," and so on, is the man in linen at that point. However, only the pronoun he is used, so it is all right if we have differing opinions about who the speaker might be, so long as we understand that it is not Daniel who is giving the message of chapter 11. Chapter 11 builds on chapter 8, although they are two separate visions. In the vision of chapter 8, Daniel saw a ram with two horns that represented the kings of Media and Persia, and then he saw a shaggy male goat that represented the kingdom of Greece. And the large horn between his eyes represented the first king of Greece, which we know from history was Alexander the Great. Still in the vision of chapter 8, Daniel was told that the male goat magnified himself exceedingly. But as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken. And in its place there came up four conspicuous horns towards the four winds of heaven. Now that we get to chapter 11, we are going to get more information about the four generals who represent the four conspicuous horns on the goat of chapter 8. But we have to finish off the information that's given about Persia before we can get to Greece, because chapter 11 begins with Persia, just as chapter 8 did. In the homework from page 63 to page 68, K. Arthur has provided a verse-by-verse commentary of chapter 11 by John Woolward and Roy Zuck. Although I consulted several other sources provided by Precept, this one was the clearest and the best. If you haven't had time to go through it, I highly recommend it. Now let's work our way through chapter 11, beginning at verse 2. "And now I tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. Then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them. As soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece." Remember that Daniel is receiving this vision in the time of Cyrus the Persian / Darius the Mede. He was not the first Persian king, but he's our starting point. The date was approximately 539 BC. The four kings that are referenced in verse 2 of Daniel 11 are, first, Cambyses, who reigned from approximately 530 to 522 BC. He died in Egypt and left no heir. His throne was then usurped by Smerdes, also known as Pseudo-Smerdes, who claimed to be the brother of Cambyses, but he lasted only 6 months on the throne. Now, either he, Pseudo-Smerdes, or his predecessor, Cambyses, one of those two men was also known as Ahasuerus in Ezra 4:6. The sources that I checked conflicted on this point. Someone named Ahasuerus in Ezra 4:6 stopped the rebuilding of the temple for a period of time. And this man who stopped the building of the temple was either Cambyses or his short-term successor, Pseudo-Smerdes. The third king of Daniel 11, verse 2, was Darius the First Hystaspes, who reigned from 521 BC to 486 BC. He was a cousin of Cambyses, and he allowed the rebuilding of the temple to start up again. The fourth was the most powerful and the most wealthy of the four. His name was Xerxes I, and he reigned from 486 to 465 BC. Unfortunately, he also was known by the name Ahasuerus, and that is recorded in the book of Esther. This is the man who took Esther to be his queen after he deposed his own queen. Verse 2 of chapter 11 of Daniel says that this king, Xerxes, also known as Ahasuerus, aroused the whole empire against the realm of Greece. He invaded Greece with an army of hundreds of thousands, one of the largest armies in the ancient world, but only 5,000 returned alive with him. For those of you who saw the movie 300, this was because a Spartan named Leonidas, with his famous band of 300, arrested the progress of Xerxes at the Pass of Thermopylae, and then later Xerxes was disastrously defeated by Themistocles at Salamis. This expedition against Greece at the Pass of Thermopylae may have occurred between chapters 1 and 2 of the book of Esther. It was after his return from this invasion that Esther was chosen as the queen of Xerxes / Ahasuerus. There were other Persian kings that followed Xerxes I, but their power began to wane because Xerxes' wars against the Greeks had stirred up Alexander, whose rise to power is described in Daniel 11, verse 3. One footnote, however, the Persian king who followed immediately after Xerxes I was named Artaxerxes I, and it was his decree in 445 BC that began the running of Daniel's 70 weeks. This is recorded in the book of Nehemiah. Back to Daniel chapter 11, verse 3. And a mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. Now verse 2 ended with a reference to Greece, and then verse 3 describes the first ruler of that empire, Alexander the Great. Remember that the Greek Empire was represented by the bronze belly and thighs of the statue of Daniel chapter 2, and by the winged leopard of Daniel chapter 7, and by the male goat with the conspicuous horn of Daniel chapter 8. Greece came from the west with great speed. Remember that the male goat of Daniel chapter 8 moved so swiftly over the ground that he didn't seem to touch the ground? Well, Greece came from the west with great speed to extract revenge against Xerxes I's invasions of Greece, and Alexander conquered Persia and continued to move with lightning speed to conquer most of the rest of the known world. His sudden death at the young age of about 32 or 33 leads us to verse 4 of Daniel chapter 11. But as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others besides them. On page 71 of your homework, there is this chart, which is very helpful in tracing the various kings that came from the four generals who divided up Alexander's empire. The four generals were Lysimachus, Cassander, Ptolemy, and Seleucus. As you can see from this chart, the latter two empires, those of Ptolemy and Seleucus, they became the kings of the south and the north that engaged in this extended tug of war over Israel, which in Daniel chapter 8 is called the Beautiful Land. Incidentally, these kings were called kings of the north or kings of the south because of their location relative to Israel. Here's the map that we looked at when we were covering Daniel chapter 8. And here are the territories that are covered by Lysimachus, Cassander, Ptolemy, and Seleucus. And here is Israel, located between the Ptolemaic and the Seleucid empires. You have a handout today that looks like this. This chart sets out the time periods for the first 35 verses of Daniel chapter 11. As you can see, we have now covered the first portion of this chart. Verse 2 took place during the time of the Persian Empire, which was represented by the silver breast and arms of the statue of Daniel chapter 2, by the bear of Daniel chapter 7, and by the ram of Daniel chapter 8. Verses 3 and 4 of Daniel chapter 11 occurred during the Greek Empire, which was represented by the bronze belly and thighs of the statue of Daniel chapter 2, the leopard with the four wings of Daniel chapter 7, and by the shaggy male goat of Daniel chapter 8. Alexander the Great was the mighty king of Daniel 11, verse 3, and his death led to the division of his kingdom among four of his generals. Then there is a break in the chart to explain that verses 5 through 35 of Daniel chapter 11 focus on only two of the four divisions of Alexander's empire. In chapter 11, they are called the kings of the north and kings of the south. The north is represented by the Seleucid Empire, later known as Syria, and the south is represented by the Ptolemaic Empire, Egypt. We saw from the map on the preceding slide that Israel, also known as the Beautiful Land, was located between these two conflicting powers. Verses 5 through 9 of Daniel chapter 11 represent the time that the kings of the south ruled over Israel. Verses 10 through 19 represent the times that, for the most part, the kings of the north ruled over Israel. As you can see from the notes in that section, however, there was a tug of war between Antiochus III and Ptolemy V. Verses 5 through 35 of Daniel chapter 11, the lower part of this chart, cover a period of almost 150 years. In tracing the struggles between Egypt and Syria, the prophecy is selective. Not every king is mentioned. The specificity of these verses, however, can be overwhelming, especially when it's combined with the ambiguity caused by our ignorance of the history of the time. Nevertheless, at least one story is worth repeating in detail just to show you how human nature does not change, and there were soap operas and drama queens in people's lives even during what we might consider to be dry and dusty ancient history. The story is foretold in verses 5 through 9 of chapter 11. Let's begin by listing the cast of characters. The players in this drama are the king of the south, who was Ptolemy II Philadelphus, his daughter Berenice, and on the other side is the king of the north, Antiochus II Theos, and his wife Laodice. Despite the fact that the king of the north, Antiochus II Theos, was already married to Laodice, the king of the south, Ptolemy II Philadelphus, demanded, for political reasons, that his daughter, Berenice, be married to Antiochus. Well, this required Antiochus to divorce his own wife, Laodice, first. The reason for the demand for the intermarriage was, of course, to make a bond between the two nations. And since the king of the south was the stronger of the two, clearly he intended by this political alliance by marriage to extend his influence over the king of the north. But the political union failed. Verse 6 says that she did not retain her position of power, nor did he remain with his power. It is not clear which man is referred to by the pronouns he and his, but it doesn't really matter, because neither of the men prospered. What happened is that within a few years of the marriage, Ptolemy, the king of the south, the more powerful one, died. Antiochus, the king of the north, then rejected Berenice, the daughter, and took back his own wife, Laodice. To gain revenge, Laodice murdered her husband, Antiochus, and his Egyptian wife, Berenice, and their infant son. This is how verse 6 describes it. She, Berenice, will be given up, along with those who brought her in, I presume that means her servants and attendants, and the one who sired her, that's her father Ptolemy, remember he died, as well as he who supported her, that would be Laodice's husband, Antiochus, whom she murdered. Back in Egypt, after Ptolemy II died, he was succeeded by his son, Ptolemy III, who happened to be the brother of Berenice, who's been murdered. That's what verse 7 means by one of the descendants of her line will arise in his place. The rest of verse 7 describes his success in prevailing militarily over the king of the north, who by this time was Seleucus Callinicus. Some sources say he's the son of Laodice, but I couldn't confirm that. But the king we know of the north could not have been Antiochus because Laodice murdered him. Verse 8 says that Berenice's brother, Ptolemy III, carried away into Egypt their gods with their metal images and their precious vessels of silver and gold. The taking of their idols indicates the total subjugation of the northern kingdom. Remember that that was how one kingdom in ancient times expressed its dominance, its conquest over another. When the Babylonians conquered Judah, the southern kingdom of Israel, when they did it, they took all the vessels out of the temple because that was their way of saying they had conquered Israel's God. Verse 9 of Daniel 11 indicates that some years later, Seleucus Callinicus of the north mounted a return attack on Egypt, but he was defeated and was forced to return to his own land. This was only the beginning of the seesaw battle between the two nations. Although Seleucus Callinicus was unsuccessful in his attempt on Egypt, his sons and brothers proved to be more successful. Verses 10 through 19 document the ascendancy of the north, Syria, over the south, Egypt, and the return of the Holy Land to Syrian northern control. This set the stage for the persecutions of Israel under Antiochus Epiphanes, and that is covered by verses 21 to 35 of chapter 11 of Daniel. The fact that a major section of this chapter 11 is devoted to a relatively obscure Syrian ruler named Antiochus IV Epiphanes, who ruled from 175 to 164 BC, serves to emphasize the importance that God placed on this little corner of the world for this short time in history. From God's perspective, this was the most important feature of the entire Third Empire. This despicable person, as he is described in verse 21, is the same as the rather small horn of Daniel chapter 8, verses 9 through 14, and 23 to 25. He is featured prominently in chapters 8 and 11 because his desecration of the Jewish temple and his terrible persecution of the Jewish people foreshadows similar events that will occur in the end times. This connection between Antiochus Epiphanes and the end times was mentioned the first time we looked at Antiochus Epiphanes in chapter 8. In Daniel chapter 8, verse 19, Gabriel said to Daniel, "Behold, I am going to let you know what will occur at the final period of the indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end." In other words, God was giving Daniel, through the angel Gabriel, a vision of the end times through the portrait of Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes was a type, a foreshadowing of the Antichrist who will come at the appointed time of the end. But God was also saying that that appointed time of the end would be an even worse time than that of Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes was the shadow, but Antichrist will be the reality who would appear at the, quote, appointed time of the end. In Daniel chapter 10, verse 21, we are told that this despicable person, Antiochus Epiphanes, did not inherit the throne legitimately, but rather usurped it by intrigue. The rightful successor to the throne was his nephew Demetrius, who was at that time being held in Rome as a hostage by the Romans. There was also a younger nephew who was still a baby, but he was there in Syria. Posing as the guardian of the baby, Antiochus Epiphanes secured the throne for himself. Then he had the baby murdered, and then he had the murderer put to death. Some historians think he himself hatched the whole plot. Verse 22 of chapter 11 refers to a prince of the covenant. This is a reference to the high priest, Onias, whose murder was ordered by Antiochus Epiphanes in 172 BC. Antiochus Epiphanes viewed him as a threat because, as the high priest, Onias was the head of the theocracy of Israel. The other references to the covenant in verses 28, 30, and 32 of chapter 11 represent Israel itself, the whole Mosaic sacrificial system, the law, the submission to the true God. It represents all of that, the covenant relationship between Israel and God. Antiochus Epiphanes' military interactions with Egypt are described well in the commentary that's provided in the homework. Antiochus Epiphanes moved against Egypt, but Rome was rising in power, and what verse 30 is telling us is that the commander of the Roman ships in Kittim, which is Cyprus, right here off the coast, told Antiochus Epiphanes to back off from Egypt. If he didn't, he would have to face Rome. So Antiochus Epiphanes was forced to back down and go back home. And you see on the map, that means moving north and passing through Israel. There he took out on the Jews his anger and frustration with the Romans. A detailed description of the violent atrocities and murders of thousands of Jews by Antiochus Epiphanes as he marched through Judea is found in 1st and 2nd Maccabees. These are books that are part of the Apocrypha. They were written in the intertestamental period between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New, and they are not considered part of the canon of the Bible by Protestant churches. Chapter 1 of 1st Maccabees records, beginning at verse 44, "And the king sent letters by messengers to Jerusalem and the cities of Judah. He directed them to follow customs strange to the land, to forbid burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings in the sanctuary, to profane Sabbaths and feasts, to defile the sanctuary and the priests, to build altars and sacred precincts and shrines for idols, to sacrifice swine and unclean animals, and to leave their sons uncircumcised. They were to make themselves abominable by everything unclean and profane, so that they should forget the law and change all the ordinances." That verse harks back to Daniel chapter 7, which says the Antichrist, this is Antiochus Epiphanes, but he's a picture of the Antichrist. Antichrist will try to change the times and the seasons. Back to 1 Maccabees, "And whoever does not obey the command of the king shall die," end quote. If a Jew disobeyed Antiochus's command and circumcised his son, Antiochus's forces would have the child mutilated, they would hang the parents, then kill the child and hang it around the hanging parent. In addition to stopping the daily sacrifices, Antiochus Epiphanes polluted the holy altar in the temple in Jerusalem by sacrificing a pig, and then he erected an idol, probably the image of Zeus, in the most holy place of the temple. This represents the abomination that makes desolate that is mentioned in verse 31. Daniel 11, verse 31. "And forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice, and they will set up the abomination of desolation." This is the abomination of desolation that Christ was referring to in Matthew 24, verse 15. There is a parallel prophecy in Daniel chapter 8, verses 23 to 25, but it is less direct. Nevertheless, it covers the same series of incidents. Daniel 11:31 echoes Daniel 9:27, although Daniel 9:27 refers to the time of the end. Daniel 9:27 says, "And he," the Antichrist, "will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering. And on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate." The desecration of the temple by Antiochus Epiphanes in 168 BC precipitated the Maccabean revolt, which is described in Daniel 11, verse 33, which says, "And those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many, yet they will fall by sword and by flame, by captivity and by plunder for many days." Antiochus Epiphanes made every attempt to brutally suppress the Maccabean revolt, and tens of thousands of Jews died horrible deaths. Nevertheless, this revolt ultimately succeeded, and the temple was cleansed and rededicated in what is now celebrated by Jews worldwide as the Festival of Lights, or Hanukkah. This gruesome chapter in history, including the persecution of Israel by Antiochus Epiphanes, his desecration of the temple, and the stopping of the daily sacrifice, is, as I alluded to a minute ago, also prophetic of the future persecution of Israel that will occur during the time of the Great Tribulation. The reference in Matthew 24:15, where Christ is describing the beginning of the Great Tribulation, is linked to the desecration of the temple by Antiochus Epiphanes as being similar in kind. Antiochus Epiphanes thus became a type of the future man of sin, and his activities foreshadow the ultimate blasphemous persecution of Israel and the desecration of their temple. Verse 35 says, "And some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and make them pure until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time." Times of persecution also purify, and this purging process that began thousands of years ago will continue until the time of the end. Thus, this verse 35 is a transition verse. The mention of the end time in verse 35 is notice that from verse 36 on, the prophecy leaps over the intervening centuries to the time of the 10 toes and the stone of Daniel 2, to the time of the 10 horns and the little horn of Daniel 7, to the time of the prince who is to come of Daniel 9. Beginning in verse 36, prophecy is unfolded that is as yet unfulfilled. But because of verses 21 to 35 describing Antiochus Epiphanes, we have had a preview of what the Antichrist, the little horn, the prince who is to come, will be and will do. This is the king of the last kingdom before God sets up his eternal kingdom. It will be the last kingdom to rule Daniel's people before God's just judgment comes. Verses 36 to 45 describe that person and his activities directly, but they too are enigmatic. Verse 36 says, "Then the king will do as he pleases, and he will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods. And he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done." Let's deal first with the text that is in bold. These descriptions of the Antichrist exalting himself and magnifying himself and speaking monstrous things against the God of gods are consistent with other passages we have seen before, and it is through the cross-references that we can get an idea of how important this description is. Daniel 7, verse 8. "While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, and three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth uttering great boasts." Daniel 7, verse 11. "I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the little horn was speaking." Daniel 7, verse 20. "The horn which had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts." Daniel 7, verse 21. "I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints," that is the children of God, "and overpowering him." Now, I've included verse 21 with verse 20 to show you that there is a direct connection, a direct correlation between the boasting and magnifying himself against the Most High God and waging war against the children of God. They are directly connected. Daniel 7, verse 25, it's all in the same verse. "He will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One. And he will intend to make alterations in times and in law, and they will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time." Revelation chapter 13, verse 5. "And there was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies, and authority to act for 42 months was given to him." Revelation 13, verse 6. "And he opened his mouth in blasphemies against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, that is, those who dwell in heaven." Verse 7 of Revelation 13, and here's where it ties together. It was given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 3 and 4, it says, "The man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction, who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship, so that he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. This will be an unparalleled display of arrogance and blasphemy." It's pointed out that many times in Scripture. This will be a defining characteristic. Now let's go back to Daniel 11:36 and let's pick up the italicized portion, which says, "He will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done." Now you may recall hearing that phrase before when we were talking about Daniel chapter 8, verse 19 a few minutes ago. That verse spoke of the final period of the indignation, which pertains to the appointed time of the end. The first thing we need to know is, what is the indignation referring to? In Hebrew, the word is za'am, Z-A-A-M, Strong's number 2195. The word comes from a root that means to foam at the mouth. It means fury, especially of God's fury against sin. What this verse 36 of Daniel 11 is saying is that the indignation will be finished when the time of God's righteous wrath and his righteous judgment upon Israel is complete, after which his righteous judgment upon the nations will begin. Well, when will his righteous wrath and judgment upon Israel be complete? We know the answer. We know from Daniel 9:24. What this means is that when the 70 weeks have been completed. Remember, Israel as a whole did not repent and return to the Lord during the 70-year captivity in Babylon. So the Lord increased the punishment sevenfold, as he had warned that he would do in Leviticus 26, verse 18. This is the message of Daniel chapter 9, when the vision of the 70 weeks, or 70 periods of 7 years each, was given to Daniel through the agency of the angel Gabriel. Further confirmation that this period of indignation is this final part of the 70th week of Daniel's 70 weeks comes from parts of the other verses we looked at before when we were talking about the boastful words that the little horn spoke. For example, we are told in Daniel 7, verse 25, that the saints of the highest one will be given into the hand of the Antichrist for a time, times, and half a time. We know that refers to the last half of Daniel's 70th week. Revelation 13, verse 5 says that authority to act for 42 months was given to him. Revelation 13, verse 7 says authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. So we can get ideas that this period of the indignation will end at the end of the 70th week. Returning to Daniel 11, verse 36, what we can now know from that verse and the accompanying cross-references is that this Antichrist will be permitted, he will be allowed by God to prosper and to have authority over the whole world for a period variously known as time, times and half a time, 42 months, 1,260 days, 3.5 years. We know that this will be the latter half of Daniel's 70th week. During that time period, he will not only blaspheme against the true God, the great I Am, but he will also exalt himself as God and demand that the world worship him as God. And he will viciously persecute all of God's people who refuse to worship him. And when the 70th week has run its course, then the six things that are set out in Daniel 9:24 will have been accomplished, and the time of the indignation will be finished. Now let's look at the next verse of Daniel 11, verse 37. Here's the NASB translation, New American Standard. "And he will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the desire of women, nor will he show regard for any other god, for he will magnify himself above them all." By the way, we could have used that as a cross-reference for verse 36 as well, because there again it says he will magnify himself above them all. But the King James Version translates verse 37 a bit differently. Neither shall he regard the God, capital G, of his fathers, nor the desire of women, nor regard any God, for he shall magnify himself above all. The Hebrew word that is used there in the text is Elohim, which is the plural name of the triune God. But it can also be interpreted to mean gods, plural, lowercase g. Technically, therefore, either translation, the New American Standard or the King James, would be correct. Those commentators who choose the King James Version that it means the God, capital G, of his fathers, assume, therefore, that the Antichrist is Jewish. Those who choose the New American Standard or the New International Version, where it says gods, plural, lowercase, assume that the Antichrist is a Gentile, that is, a non-Jew. One fact we can take notice of is that the usual practice in the book of Daniel, when he is referring to the God of Israel, the great I Am, he would use the word Jehovah, which when it is translated into English is all capital letters, Lord, capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. Thus, the absence of this name Jehovah in a passage where one would expect it if the reference were to the God of Israel is significant, and it appears to give more weight to the New American Standard translation, the gods, plural, of his fathers. But whatever god or gods his ancestors worshipped, he had no regard for them. The phrase that is translated as desire of women has been the subject of much speculation. There are several possibilities. One is that it could be alluding to the desire of every Jewish woman to be the mother of the Messiah. That would tie in with the King James translation of that verse. Another possible interpretation is that he was just not attracted to women. Another possibility is that given his general disregard for all the normal sensibilities of civilized society, he used women indiscriminately, regardless of their desire for marriage. Yet another possibility is that it is the reference to the cult of Tammuz, T-A-M-M-U-Z, who's also called the Queen of Heaven. Her cult was popular for centuries. References to the Queen of Heaven appear in Jeremiah chapter 7, verse 18, Jeremiah 44, verses 17 to 19, and verse 25. This same idol goddess is called Tammuz in Ezekiel 8, 14. Part of which interpretation you might choose would be whether the text is referring to the desire by women or the normal male desire for women. But I think the interpretation that makes the most sense, because it is consistent with the character of the Antichrist as we see it set out in all these biblical passages, is that he will have no regard for women in the sense that he will be as cruel to them as he would be to a man. He will spare no one who refuses or fails to worship him, and there will be no clemency and no leniency for women or children. If you put all three of these phrases together, that he does not regard the God of his fathers or the gods of his fathers, 2, nor does he regard the desire of women, 3, nor will he show regard for any other God, these three together are giving the picture of one who is so completely hard-hearted that he will defy anyone and anything and do exactly as he pleases, and anyone who gets in his way will be mowed down. Which brings us to verse 38, and again I will list both the NASB and the King James. Verse 38, but instead he will honor a God of fortresses, a God whom his fathers did not know. He will honor him with gold, silver, costly stones, and treasures. That's the NASB. Here's the King James. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces, and a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and with precious stones and pleasant things. This verse 38 is relatively clear. The Antichrist will honor this God of forces or God of fortresses instead of honoring the God of his fathers, or for that matter, any other God. The general idea is clear, that he will show disrespect or contempt for all other gods and honor this one, this God alone, while still demanding that the world acknowledge him as God. Not only does he blaspheme against God by rejecting him as well as all false gods, but he also blasphemes against God by claiming to be God himself. Verse 39, again in both translations, New American Standard. And he will take action against the strongest of fortresses with the help of a foreign god. He will give great honor to those who acknowledge him, and he will cause them to rule over the many and will parcel out land for a price. King James Version. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange god, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory, and he shall cause them to rule over many, and shall divide the land for gain. The difference in the two translations of this verse is that in the New American Standard, the Antichrist honors those who acknowledge him by causing them to rule over others, but in the King James translation, it is he himself who does the acknowledging. He acknowledges and honors the strange or the foreign god. This verse 39 describes the Antichrist making war and giving honor either to the foreign god or to those who acknowledge him, that is the Antichrist. He will be establishing his position as a world leader by defeating his enemies, and he will try to consolidate the various nations and political factions who are willing to give him their allegiance. Well, who is this foreign or strange god, this god of forces or fortresses, who helps him? My own opinion, and it's just that, an opinion, is that the foreign god, this strange god, this god of forces or of fortresses, is none other than Satan. After all, Revelation 13 says that Satan, the dragon, invests Antichrist, the first beast, with his own power and authority, so it would be logical for the Antichrist to be relying on Satan to accomplish his goals. But that is just my opinion. My opinion is not, however, inconsistent with some writers who have suggested that the foreign god or strange god is the woman riding the scarlet beast of Revelation 17. They say that the woman represents a false religious system that Satan has used and will use to deceive the nations concerning Christ, all in his, that is, Satan's, attempt to destroy the elect of God. Revelation 17, verse 6, describes this woman as a harlot who is drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus. She's also described in Revelation 17, verse 2 as the one with whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality. That means spiritual immorality. And those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality. Since this harlot is sitting on the scarlet beast that has the seven heads that represent the beast nations that have persecuted the Jews over the course of history, some commentators have concluded that this harlot must be a powerful religious force that over this same course of history has controlled the kings of the nations. She will have the same relationship with the final beast empire of Satan, using her international influence to help the Antichrist assemble his 10-nation coalition and eventually rule the world. One commentator suggested that this foreign or strange god of forces or fortresses is not a person or even a false religious system, but is rather simply the power to make war. This final world ruler, the Antichrist, will place his trust in military power. He, the Antichrist, will be the embodiment of the combination of materialism, militarism, and religion, this last religion, because remember, he demands that the world worship him as God. The rest of verse 39 of Daniel chapter 11 tells us that the Antichrist will parcel out land for a price. The price, of course, will be total allegiance to the Antichrist. The time of the end, or the end time, that was mentioned in Daniel 8:19 and again in Daniel 11:35 appears again in verse 40 of chapter 11 to make it clear that the military struggle described here is one which will characterize the end of the age. The king of verses 36 to 39, that is the Antichrist, will be attacked by the king of the south and the king of the north. Earlier in chapter 11, the king of the south represented the Ptolemaic Empire centralized in Egypt. The battles described there were fulfilled historically. Here at the end of chapter 11, the king of the south is the leader of a political and military force that comes from somewhere south of Israel, but it may include other countries as well as Egypt. The warfare described here at the end of chapter 11, however, does not match anything in history. The king of the north in the earlier verses of chapter 11 represented the Seleucid Empire or Syria, and the battles described there are history. But here at the end of chapter 11, the king of the north probably includes all the political and military forces of the countries to the north of Israel, perhaps including the areas of ancient Assyria and Babylon. Again, the battles described beginning in verse 40 have not yet happened in recorded history. In these battles, invaders come from the north and the south, and later from the east. In earlier verses, the Antichrist is pictured as an absolute world ruler. But there are other cross-references from Revelation that I'd like to bring in at this time, which also indicate the existence of a one-world government at this time. Revelation 13, verse 7 says, "It was given to him," Antichrist, "to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him." Revelation 13, verse 12, "And he," that is the second beast, "exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and he makes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast." Revelation 13, verses 16 and 17, "He," the second beast, "causes all, the great and the small, the rich and the poor, the free men and the slaves, to be given a mark," verse 17, "and he provides that no one should be able to buy or to sell except the one who has the mark." Revelation 17, verses 12 and 13, "The 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings, and they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. They have one purpose, and they give their power and authority to the beast." These verses, out of the several passages throughout Revelation, tell us that not only is there one world government, but there is also one world economy, and it is all under the power and authority of the beast, who is the Antichrist. Thus, these battles that we're looking at here at the end of chapter 11 of Daniel seem to be a form of rebellion against the Antichrist and indicate an attempt to break up his one-world government. Let's look at verse 40. "At the end time, the king of the south will collide with him, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots, with horsemen, and with many ships, and he will enter countries, overflow them, and pass through." The first question we want to ask is, who is he of verse 40 referring to? The king of the south, the king of the north, or the world leader, Antichrist? The answer comes from the following verses, which indicate that the Antichrist is mostly successful in quelling this rebellion. This would be consistent with everything we've studied up to this point, because we've seen that the Antichrist will have been given power over all people, nations, tribes, and tongues for a set period of time, which we know as time, times, and half a time, or 42 months, 1,260 days, or 3.5 years. Verse 41 says, "He will also enter the beautiful land," which we know means Israel, and many countries will fall, but these will be rescued out of his hand: Edom, Moab, and the foremost of the sons of Ammon. Well, where are Edom, Moab, and Ammon? This is a map of the promised land. Here are the locations of ancient Edom, Moab, and Ammon. To orient ourselves, when I move to the next map, you can see that Moab is next to the Dead Sea, and here's the Sea of Galilee up here, way up north. Now, as I move to the next map showing the current boundaries of Israel, you can orient yourself by locating first these two bodies of water. Here's the Dead Sea. Here's the Sea of Galilee. So these circles show you the modern locations of ancient Edom, Moab, and Ammon. Where are they? They are all in the area of modern Jordan. Verse 41 of Daniel 11 says, that area will be divinely protected, rescued out of his hand. Some scholars think that this may be the area referenced in Revelation 12, 6, and 14, which is called the wilderness, to which the woman who represents Israel flees for protection from the dragon, who is Satan, and the first beast, who is Antichrist. Let's look at the last four verses of Daniel chapter 11, verse 42. Then he will stretch out his hand against other countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. But he will gain control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and Libyans and Ethiopians will follow at his heels. Remember that this book of Daniel was written in the 6th century BC. Although Egypt is today primarily where Egypt was then, I can only show you on a map where Libya and Ethiopia are today. But I can make no representation regarding whether those are the countries that God was talking about in this prophecy. The most I can say is that they are the names of countries in the vicinity of current Egypt, and they are south of the land of Israel. Verse 44 says, but rumors from the east and from the north will disturb him, and he will go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many. Earlier in chapter 11, when we were looking at Antiochus Epiphanes, we saw that he was prevented by the Romans from pursuing his attack on Egypt, and he was forced by the Romans to return north, passing through Israel, where he took out his frustration on the Jews. Here in verse 44, we see that the Antichrist will move along the same path as his prototype, traveling north from Egypt through the Holy Land. The difference, of course, is that the Antichrist will be successful in his conquest of Egypt and the nearby nations. Verse 45 says, and he will pitch the tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain. That means in Jerusalem. Yet he will come to his end and no one will help him. These last four verses of chapter 11 describe extended warfare with more than one battle involved. It is possible that the rumors from the east may be related to the passage in Revelation chapter 9 about the invasion of the 200 million man army crossing the Euphrates, which is dried up so they can cross. As I said, it is possible, but it's hard to say because I haven't been able to establish at what point in Daniel's 70th week these particular events of Daniel 11 are occurring. Are they in the first half or are they in the second half of Daniel's 70th week? But at the same time that the rumors from the east are disturbing the Antichrist, there's another invasion reported from the north. The Antichrist, the world ruler, responds to both with great wrath, and he destroys and annihilates many. And he establishes his palace, the tents of his royal pavilion in Jerusalem, which is located between the Mediterranean Sea and the Dead Sea. It is interesting to note that the center of all these end times events is Israel in the center of the earth and the Middle East. To some extent, the nations of Eastern Europe and North Africa are also involved. But notice that all the world powers of recent centuries, including Western Europe, Great Britain, the United States, as well as the rest of North and South America, Australia, New Zealand, most of the Far East, and most of Africa, will be relegated to insignificant roles, if any, in the last days. We Americans have trouble imagining a world where we are not the center of the world, the center of the world's attention, and the leader in world politics. But if the end times are relatively soon, then our decline on the world scene is imminent, and in fact, we are already witnessing it. But do not go to the other extreme and take comfort in the fact that America will be off the main stage. There will be no hiding from the forces of the Antichrist, and his dominion will extend worldwide. We too will be a nation subjugated by the Antichrist and forcefully submitted to his authority. We can, however, take comfort in the fact that the Lord has revealed the end of the Antichrist and his kingdom to us. Once again, just as the statue of Daniel chapter 2 was crushed by the stone cut out without hands, and just as Daniel 7 describes the judgment of the beast by the Ancient of Days, we are assured that the Antichrist, also known as the first beast of Revelation 13, also known as the little horn of Daniel 7, will come to his end and no one will help him. That's what Daniel 11:45 says. Revelation 19 verse 20 gives us the specifics of his end. It says, "And the beast was seized, and with him the false prophet who performed the signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire, which burns with brimstone." The very next verse in Daniel takes us to chapter 12. But this passage that we're looking at today really includes the first three verses of chapter 12. So let me incorporate just these three into our lesson on chapter 11. Daniel 12, beginning at verse 1. "Now at that time, Michael, the great prince who stands guard over the sons of your people, will arise. And there will be a time of distress, such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, everyone who is found written in the book, will be rescued. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, but the others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. And those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, and those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever." Verse 1 of chapter 12 says, at that time. What time? Well, what are we talking about in the immediately preceding verses, which are part of the same passage, chapter 11, verses 36 to 45? We are talking about Daniel's 70th week, mostly, but not entirely, about the latter half, described variously as time, times, and half a time, 42 months, etc. These first three verses of chapter 12 cover the same time period as the last verses of chapter 11. In other words, the events that are described here at the beginning of chapter 12 are not subsequent to the events described in the preceding verses. They coincide with them chronologically. This verse 1 of chapter 12 is describing the great tribulation that Jesus referred to in Matthew 24:15. Here it is called a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. When you consider all the atrocities that man has inflicted on man over the course of human history, and then consider that this time will be something so terrible that there is no precedent in history for it, that means the Great Tribulation must be beyond the worst that we can possibly imagine. Verse 2 of chapter 12 of Daniel confirms that this entire passage that begins in chapter 11, verse 36, and goes through the third verse of chapter 12 is about the very last days, because verse 2 refers to the resurrection of the dead as they are described in Revelation 20, verses 4 through 6. Together, these three verses of Daniel chapter 12 tell us that Israel, God's chosen nation, has a special place in history all the way to the end of days. It will be the focal point of the end times. But we also see that there will be some in Israel who will be rescued. Everyone who is found written in the book. Their song of deliverance is recorded in the first verses of Revelation chapter 14. There is also the hope of resurrection to eternal life for those who are martyred for their faith. Verse 3 of chapter 12 says that those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, and those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. Well, this verse harks back to verse 33 of chapter 11, which described the persecution by Antiochus Epiphanes of those Jews who were faithful to God and refused to abandon him or his law. Daniel 11 verse 33 says, those who have insight among the people will give understanding to the many, yet they will fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by plunder. In other words, those who had insight and understanding, like Daniel himself, or like the men who led and participated in the Maccabean revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes, they led others to righteousness, and their reward will be an eternal reward. Thus, this passage that we've looked at from Daniel 11, verse 36 to chapter 12, verse 3, covers the closing days of the times of the Gentiles, specifically the 70th week of Daniel, with the emphasis on the last 3.5 years, which Jesus described as the Great Tribulation. In spite of satanic support, the Antichrist world government will face large rebellions and factional disputes and will wage war with huge casualties. A few more details about the end of the times of the Gentiles are provided in chapter 12, which we will look at in the last couple of lessons. The explosion of technology in recent years has literally changed the face of the world. Privacy is, or maybe has already become, a thing of the past. Passages in Revelation chapter 13 about a world economy based entirely upon the taking of a mark of a beast are no longer the stuff of science fiction. They have become frightening possibilities that one day will become terrifying realities. We must have insight and understanding so that we are not deceived by the Antichrist when he comes. It is vitally important for us to keep our eyes on Israel and to be praying for the salvation of the Jews. They are still God's chosen people, and God will hold us responsible for taking any stand against them. Genesis 12:3 still says, and God still means, that he will bless those who bless Israel, and he will curse those who curse Israel. If Daniel's 70th week comes in our lifetimes, we will need the insight, the understanding, and the courage of Daniel to see us through. Unlike most of the Old Testament saints, however, we have the indwelling Holy Spirit to guide us. Let us use the time we have now to fill our hearts and minds with biblical knowledge and godly wisdom. Our final hymn. God of grace and God of glory, on thy people pour thy power. Crown thine ancient church's story. Bring her bud to glorious flower. Grant us wisdom. Grant us courage for the facing of this hour. Lo, the hosts of evil round us scorn thy Christ, assail his ways. From the fears that long have bound us, free our hearts to faith and praise. Grant us wisdom, grant us courage for the living of these days. Cure thy children's warring madness, bend our pride to thy control. Shame our wanton selfish gladness, rich in things and poor in soul. Grant us wisdom, grant us courage, lest we miss thy kingdom's goal. Save us from weak resignation to the evils we deplore. Let the gift of thy salvation be our glory evermore. Grant us wisdom, grant us courage, serving thee whom we adore. Amen.